This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll talk with Jim Brown, the well-known Louisiana politico, five times elected statewide. And now he is observing politics as a pundit and as a publisher. And we'll talk with him about what's going on in our world. This looms as a huge year politically in Louisiana. The eyes of the nation could be on our state come December, when Mary Landrieu and quite probably Bill Cassidy will be in a runoff for a U.S. Senate seat that could determine control of the upper chamber of the United States Senate. Also, Matt Herron, a photographer on the Freedom Summer of 1964. His book is Mississippi Eyes, Photographs About the Civil Rights Movement. But now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. We welcome your input and insights. And Jim Brown is with us. If you're calling outside the area, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Jim Brown, of course, selected five times statewide, state senator prior to that, and a man who's had many lives, including a world champion relay team that included Bullet Bob Hayes, Paul Warfield. Ralph Boston, was he the other one?
You mentioned Ralph Boston,
and Bob Hayes.
Yeah, Warfield, Boston, myself, and Bob Hayes. I was the hurdler.
What's wrong with this picture?
but you had three entries in each event, so that the top three sprinters, and they picked me up as the fourth in the hurdles, and then they said, okay, Brown, you're going to start off. And I had to hand off to Hayes, number two, who was the fastest man in the world. I got goosebumps thinking about, oh, please don't leave me, please don't leave me.
You know? He was the fastest man in the world, and one of the athletes who was able to convert that speed into a great NFL career as a wide receiver, catching passes for Danny
died a
Don
few years
Merrick.
Ago, diabetic, and died a few years ago. I talked to him about 6 months before he died over in Tampa, Florida.
There you go. You came in the studio today, and we fist bumped. You don't shake hands anymore. what's going on?
I'm 74 years old, and as most of your listeners do, you get the winter colds, and you get the flu or the hay fever and all these various things. And I read a good bit about the germs you pick up, and I'm not trying to be overreactive, but when I go into the supermarket, I take the wipes and wipe off the handles, and I'm fist bumping. And Jim, let me tell you, in the last winter, all my family got their winter colds. I got no colds. I feel better, and I'm just not picking up other people's problems, if you will. So don't feel bad if I fist bump you, but that's just my way of trying to keep myself healthy as I get into older age.
Well, we fist bumped, but we did not chest bump.
Right.
Maybe we will if we have a really good show. But Jim Brown is a man, we could talk with him about media, we could talk with him about politics, sports. He not only is a publisher of renown, the publisher of the Edwin Edwards biography by Leo Honeycutt, which now has sold, over 100,000?
Over 100,000. The largest selling book by a Louisiana author in the history of the state. Just amazing. I'm just dumbfounded it sold so many books.
Amazing. There's still a market for Edwin Edwards, and there may be a market for him politically. But your daughter, Campbell Brown, certainly has exceeded you as far as national acclaim. She went right to the top of broadcasting, and
she did.
I didn't know it, but Tim Russert was a mentor of hers.
She said, "Dad, I want to get into television." And she went to LSU, and I said, "That's just a tough, tough gig." She was working in Washington for a congressman, and I said, "You know, that's just hard, hard business. So many people want to be into television news." So she was persistent, and she started off, put out a little resume. I helped her put it together, got a job in Topeka, Kansas, at a very small station, being a reporter, went out there. And I knew the Secretary of State out there that served with me, and he was nice enough to loan her an apartment. But she got out there and started putting out a resume again, got a job in Richmond, Virginia, named the top political reporter in Richmond, Virginia, then went to Baltimore, was doing the Miss America pageant for the local Baltimore station, covering it because they thought Miss Baltimore might win the pageant. Tim Russett happened to walk by and see her interview, a stand-up interview. He said, come on, let's have a cup of coffee. And he hired her to go to MSNBC, was her mentor when she became, she wanted to be a White House correspondent for NBC. They thought she was too young. Russett went up to the top news people, said, you got to hire this girl. She can really do well. And then she went on to be host of the Today Show, hosted her own show on CNN for a number of years in the evening. Now, Jim, she heads up a huge educational foundation in New York City, does not get paid for it, all volunteer. I went to a dinner 3 weeks ago. Governor Jeb Bush was the keynote speaker. She raised 12, it was not, he was the keynote speaker honoring her, my daughter. She raised $12 million, and she's involved in about 32 charter schools, and she's just really involved in trying to change education, as so many people are here in Louisiana. She's doing it up in New York City.
Well, what do you think of Governor Jindal on this Common Core issue, since we're talking about education? I noticed today a scathing editorial in The Advocate from Dan Juno calling Governor Jindal's actions shameful. And this is from a political ally. What is going on?
I've just talked to so many people who are stunned, thinking that what a bad decision it is on part of the governor, both educational-wise, as Dan Juno pointed out in The Advocate today. Dan Juno was the head of the Lobby Business Group, a real ally of Jindal for years. But not only are the educators lined up against Jindal, I don't think it made good sense politically around the rest of the country. You've got 40 states that have adopted Common Core. It may play well with maybe the hard conservative right, and maybe Jindal feels like that's something he can do to enhance his presidential ambitions. It's not good for the kids, not good for the state, and I don't see the value either politically or educationally in him doing so. I think it's a lose-lose situation for him, quite frankly.
297-5633 if you'd like to join Jim Brown, who served as Secretary of State for two terms and insurance commissioner for almost three, and former state senator as well, ran for governor in 1987 and lost to his close friend, Edwin Washington Edwards. And, of course, Edwin Edwards has resurfaced as a candidate for Congress, and we've talked about it on this program. If he is elected, he will be the last member of the greatest generation to be a member of the U.S. House. He'll be the last World War II veteran to be a member of Congress.
Oldest member of Congress, 91, got defeated here in the primary.
Ralph Hall.
Edwards at 87 will be, I don't know if he'll be the oldest member of Congress, but certainly be one of the oldest if he's successful in being elected. And I understand, I was told, I don't have firsthand knowledge, but that he hired his campaign manager now was worked for Vice President Joe Biden, was his advance man for years, and that Governor Edwards has just hired him to run his campaign. So
who is that?
I want to say Ari Flashman. I don't know.
Flasher?
What? He was on the Biden's advance man for a good while, and now is coming down to run, and from Louisiana, and coming back to run the Edwards campaign. And I believe that's correct.
So this is not a lark by our former governor.
I don't think so. No, I had dinner last night with several folks he'd called about raising funds. Apparently, he's really getting into the fundraising, and there'll be some reports coming out in July. But no, I think he's. I'm on his. I want to stay attuned to it. So on Facebook and his Twitter account, he posts things up there every day. And so I think he's very serious about this race. And I thought it was interesting that every other candidate supported Governor Jindal's efforts to kill the lawsuit to allow the lawsuit to take place involving the coast and making oil companies pay back damages. And Edwards is very much for the lawsuit. And I think he's got a good issue there. I think popular opinion throughout the district is highly in favor of holding oil companies that do damage accountable. And so whoever he gets in the runoff with, that's going to be a pretty strong demarcation issue along that line. So it's going to be interesting to watch. And Well, you may want to talk about this U.S. Senate race. I was telling some folks last night, I think two things that Mary Landrieu has going for, there are two things. One is Edwin Edwards, because in a runoff, he'll be trying to help get out a Democratic vote that will help Landrieu. So Landrieu and Edwards don't apparently get along very well, but he could be the key for her reelection, quite frankly. So all these Machiavellian ties play into this election coming up and what is looking like shaping up to be one of the most interesting election cycles we've ever seen in the last 30, 40 years.
Landrieu against Bill Cassidy, probably, although Rob Maness has now raised over $1 million.
17,000 contributors from Louisiana to the Tea Party candidate, Rob Maness.
And he, by the way, he corrected me. I was calling him Maness, and he says my name's Maness, but I'm taking him. That's correct pronunciation. But he is coming after Cassidy hard. When you read his, and I get his campaign messages daily, almost all of them are directed at Congressman Cassidy.
Well, I think he's playing the role we're seeing tonight, for example, in Mississippi, or playing out today, a major Republican conservative Tea Party candidate taking on the establishment Republican, Thad Cochran, over in Mississippi. And we saw that true with the conservative Republican beating Eric Cantor, the majority leader of the House up in Virginia. Maness hopes to be in that same vein. He feels like Landrieu has a runoff spot. And I'll tell you what, if we had the system that every other state has, mm-hmm. where you don't have this open primary, where it was two Republicans trying to get into the runoff, Maness would be giving Cassidy a heck of a scare. The system we have in Louisiana works against the colonel because you pretty much got to give one runoff spot to Landrieu, so they're both fighting for that extra runoff spot, Cassidy and Maness, for the extra runoff spot. But if this were any other state, I think Cassidy would be forgetting all about Mary Landrieu and concentrating on going after Colonel Maness.
Well, what do you see in the ultimate showdown, which will, I would say there's a 95% chance at least of a runoff. Senator Landrieu is going to get one runoff slot. That's almost a given. And she'll be in a runoff with a Republican, and the conventional wisdom is that it will be Bill Cassidy. What do you think?
I think Cassidy should be way ahead at this stage. I think I mentioned that Landrieu's got two things going for her. One is Edwin Edwards. The second is Bill Cassidy. I'm going to write a column next week. I write a column for a number of newspapers in the state, Jim. And I've made maybe 20 or 30 calls around the state, primarily to newspaper editors or people in the media that I know, in a cross-section of areas, Grant Parish up in Colfax, my home of Faraday up in Monroe, over in Mansfield. And everywhere I call, they say they've never seen Bill Cassidy. He's not been up there. He's done what many Republicans are doing, trying to raise all this money to pound Landrieu on television. Now, it seems in the last week or two he's getting out, but people just don't know Cassidy that well. And Maness is working very, very hard in the retail politics, where he goes in and shakes the hands. And I was over in Ameet, spoke to the Ameet Kiwanis Club a couple of weeks ago, went by the local barber shop over there where all the politics takes place in the barbershop. McAllister, the congressman, who now is reconsidering, he had been by the day before. Rob Maness had been by the barbershop.
Where's this barbershop?
This is in Ameet, over in Ameet. Right? That's where all the politics hang out. But never heard of Bill Cassidy. I mean, heard of him, but never's come by, to his knowledge, never been over in a meet. And so Cassidy announced a year and a half ago, and he said
hasn't been to the barbershop in
a meet. And you laugh about that, but in the time of all this pounding going on, retail politics makes a difference.
It does.
And so Cassidy so far has not been that hands-on. He's been in Washington raising money. But I think that he's got some catching up to do because, again, with Mary Landrieu voting with President Obama 97% of the time, with the Obamacare issue, the fact that she rarely is back here in Louisiana, she's pretty much a Washington product, lives up there, doesn't come home very much. The Republicans should be way, way ahead in a red state like Louisiana. And Landrieu's making it a nip and tuck race. And I think, and then of course, you pointed this out again, the runoff could come down. This is a good likely scenario to where, you see, most people don't know this. This election is going to take place on the first Tuesday in November, which all elections all over the country will take place. But we're the only state that will have a runoff 30 days later. Every other Senate race will be determined in the country on the first Tuesday in November. So the Landrieu Cassidy race will be the focus and the attention of the entire nation. And if the one vote or the one election means who controls the U.S. Senate, you will see not just tens of millions, probably $100 million spent down here in this election.
We will go to the phones with Jim Brown, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Frank Barnett is producing Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Jim Brown, the guest, Mike and Zachary, good morning. You're on the air with former Secretary of State, former Insurance Commissioner, former State Senator and heralded publisher, columnist, and talk show host, Jim Brown. Hi, Mike.
Hi, this is Mike from Zachary.
Yeah, we know that.
The impression was given in the show that most educators are in favor of the Common Core. It just so happens that I'm a retired educator, and I write a blog for educators and for parents. And in February, I conducted a poll on my blog as to whether my readers supported Common Core or not. And 70% of the respondents, and there were almost 3,000 people who responded to the poll, said that they did not think the Common Core was appropriate. Most of the people who responded were educators who are actually in charge of implementing the Common Core, and some were parents. But by a great majority, they felt that Common Core was not appropriate. And I've studied the Common Core in detail, and I think there are a lot of things wrong with it.
All right.
Well, Mike, the question was directed at the political consequences of Bobby Jindal. I didn't say anything about educators all being for or against Common Core. Jindal was part of the group that developed Common Core. This was developed not by the Obama administration or by the federal government. It was developed by governors around the country, and Jindal actively supported Common Core. It was put in place in Louisiana back in 2010. And today, virtually every major educational grouping here, the BC Board, head of the Department of Education, John White, who was brought in to improve education. I saw today that the Board of Regents has put in place processes that you've got to implement Common Core. So I'm saying that Jindal, as far as the educational leadership, is on one side of the issue, having developed Common Core, and everyone else is on the other side of the issue. And I was saying that from a political point of view, it looked like perhaps Jindal was being an opportunist, that he was for it before he was against it. And so that was the point of the question. I mean, we can spend the entire morning arguing Common Core. I'm not part of the Common Core debate. I'm just trying to analyze the political implications. And I think when 40 states have signed on to it, doesn't make good politics for Bobby Jindal. But hey, I may be wrong, but that was the point of my analysis, the politics, not so much the value of a Common Core.
297-5633. Thank you, Mike. Jim Brown with us. Here's a story from yesterday. State Treasurer John Kennedy announced late yesterday that House Bill 142, requiring additional financial accountability and legislative oversight of state contracts, was vetoed by the governor. The bill was passed by the House 98-0, by the Senate 37-0, and Governor Jindal vetoed it. John Kennedy, perhaps being a bit tongue-in-cheek, says, "I thank Governor Jindal for his consideration."
I'll tell you what, it just one more point of where Jindal is coming from. Look, Jim, you and I have been observing these things. I was part of the process for 28 years, and I've never seen such a bizarre response from a governor. I've watched John McKithen, Jimmy Davis coming up through the Edwards years, and Mike Foster. All these folks were very predictable. Maybe there's a method to his madness. I don't know what the method is. Those who are cynical, and I've withheld judgment, But those who are cynical say that Jindal is being an opportunist, trying to focus everything he does on possibly being a contender for the 2016 presidential election. But when you've got legislation overwhelmingly supported without any opposition in the legislature, and it's something that brings in governmental accountability, mm-hmm. which I thought Jindal ran on when he ran for governor, it's just very, very puzzling that he would veto a legislation along those lines.
Carlo writes that the last governor of Louisiana who was more than 6 feet tall was John McKithen. We've had, Carlo says, too many governors with so-called little man syndrome. What do you think?
I wrote a column about a month ago. John McKithen died, I think, about 15 years ago, and wrote a column on that anniversary. McKithen is not really, history has not given him all the credit he's due. First of all, he built the Superdome, envisioned the Superdome, which was a great asset to New Orleans. Second of all, he ran and won as a segregationist, but then became the moderate governor in the South that realized that there had to be a balance in terms of racial relations. I think one of his greatest attributes is recognizing that water was such an asset for us. McKithen was the guy that encouraged the chemical plants to come in and all the industrial development up and down the river. So I'm very fond of John McKithen. He got me into politics, by the way. Mm-hmm. He's the one that talked me into running for state senator. I was living right by him in Columbia. I told a story in my column, Jim, about I went to the Columbia High School football game and at Caldwell Parish High School football game one night to shake hands as people were coming into the game. I'm running for state senator. John McKithen came into the stadium. He was there to see his daughter as a cheerleader. And it just started to rain, and he stood there at the entrance of the stadium, and everybody that came in, he said, meet this young man, Jim Brown. He's going to be your next state senator. And he was getting wet, and I was kind of concerned about him. He got all wet, but he stayed right there with me. Well. A very quick story. John McKithen lived in Columbia, would not put in a watch line. He wouldn't put in a state telephone line. He has three daughters who are on the telephone all the time, and his chief of staff told me they used to have to call a state trooper up in Monroe to drive 30 miles down to the governor's residence in Columbia to ask the girls to get off the telephone because the governor had some state business to conduct, and they couldn't get him on the telephone. So he was a very frugal guy, but I'm a big John McKithen
fan.
Well,
and he was a tall man, and I hadn't thought about it until Carlo brought it up. We had Edwards, Treen, Foster, Jindal, Romer, not one of them above 6 feet tall. Jim Brown, how tall are you?
I am 6'2", and let me tell you, that doesn't bode very well for Bobby Jindal, little Bobby Jindal, you know. So, in fact, when I ran in 1987, someone asked me at a press club meeting with all the other candidates there, what's the biggest problem you think we've got to deal with in Louisiana? And I said, short governors, because I had Edwards and Romer and all the little guys, Bobby, another Billy Tozan. If we just get rid of these short governors, we'll be okay.
He wanted to be governor, but the taller candidate who runs for president usually wins. But I thought about this. David Vitter's not 6 feet tall. Jay Darden's not 6 feet
tall. That's
right.
That's right. That candidate may be lurking out there. He may be lurking out there.
Maybe so. 297-5633. A question here from Jonathan about Mississippi. Tonight, the votes will come in. Thad Cochran and Chris McDaniel, who, by the way, he's a lawyer, but he's best known in Mississippi as a talk show host. He was a Moon Griffon-type talk show host, very conservative. In fact, I've told Moon that he could probably win an election in Louisiana. He certainly could win that 5th District congressional seat if he ran. This guy McDaniel's probably going to win this race. At least that's what the smart money says.
That's what the pundits are saying up that way. He's a Tea Party candidate, a little off the wall, little I don't want to say bizarre, but on the other hand, you've got an interesting mix-up in Washington right now to our neighbors out west. When you look at what's happening out there in terms of all the Texas politics being in complete topsy-turvy activity. Mississippi, Arkansas, hot races up there. Tea Party very active, but Democrats are not lying down. And you got Ted Cruz, the senator over in Texas, who was pretty much like McDaniel, an unknown, didn't have any money, pulled the upset, and now is stirring up politics nationally. This is one of the most fascinating, interesting, and quite frankly, disturbing times we've had in our political history, both in the state as well as on the national level.
297-5633, another inquiry about St. George and what was it Tip O'Neill said, that all politics is local. And the St. George story, it's not over. Yesterday, Woody Jenkins went before the Baton Rouge Press Club, and he made his case that the annexation was illegal. He's filed suit to stop it. He says he was assaulted by, I guess, what he presumes pro-St. George or pro-Baton Rouge, not St. George people, at his house on North Foster. But where's this going? This is a story that people in this community are engaged about.
I don't know just what it reflects. You know, we don't have a united legislative delegation in Baton Rouge and the surrounding area. Most areas do. It just doesn't seem to click well. The city and surrounding areas have not done very well. You have the growth of the school board situation in Baker. And so there's a lot of secession talk and activities within this part of the state. You don't see that up in Monroe. You don't see that in Shreveport. For some reason, in our area, there is much more efforts to kind of split away and form your own little base. You've seen that down in Ascension Parish. The growth of the biggest shopping center in the area is going to go out in Denman Springs. Normally, you say, hey, that's great. Let's kind of bring it all together in some type of unity. Let's have a coalition of leaders to talk about these issues. We don't do that in Baton Rouge. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, if there's fault. I just don't know, not that close to it, but I just find that almost every level, you don't have the synergy that you seem to have building in New Orleans, for example, getting the North Shore and getting Jefferson Parish together. There's much more unity in other parts of the state than there is here in Baton Rouge. You know, the governor could do something about that, quite frankly. He could step in and say, listen, we got to bring all this together. Let's sit out at the table and start a discussion. Perhaps the mayor of Baton Rouge could. Someone needs to get that discussion going, because right now we're going in a number of different directions, and St. George is just one element of a much broader issue and a much broader problem.
297-5633 for Jim Brown. John in Lafayette. Hi, John. You're on the air with Jim.
Good morning. I'm calling from Livingston, Louisiana.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to confuse the issue.
Livingston, Lafayette. There's not much different. This is John.
There are a lot of days that I'd rather be from Lafayette. Now, Mr. Brown had mentioned Governor McKithen a moment ago, and that history probably has not remembered Governor McKithen as it should. And I think the same thing could probably be said about Mr. Brown. You know, it seems like we're very, very quick to you know, to try people in the media, and then when their names are cleared years or sometimes decades later, the media is very quiet at that point. It's a big story when things happen. I just want to ask Mr. Brown, is that just the nature of the beast, and is it going to always be that way, or is there some method or mechanism in the future to where a man can clear his name and take his rightful place in history?
Well, you know, the press and the public moves on to other stories. You know, what we all have our short life of a story. You move on to other things. And most of you, the listeners, know I had my run-in with the federal government. And I think it's up to the individuals how you handle something like that. I could have just kind of slithered off into the sunset and been very quiet and moved back home to Faraday or something like that, or just been kind of innocuous in terms of what I did. I chose not to do that. I felt like what happened to me was wrong, and number one. And number two, I felt like I still had a lot to say. I still do. And a lot of people don't agree with everything I have to say, but I reflect that in columns I write and in radio shows I do. And so I'm out there talking about it, and I appreciate your thoughts, and I'm trying to still build a legacy for the future.
Well, you were known as a tough campaigner, and some of these people who ran against you, they were hit hard. Of course, you won most of the time, but I think of Sally Nungesser. You pounded away at her. Now Sally and George Kennedy are on the same team, by the way. They're both working for Jay Darden. But Alan Boudreau, the guy you beat in 99, this guy, he'd never been in politics. He gets in a runoff with you, and boy, did you do a number on this guy. And if I recall, the guy, he's so upset, and his wife is, that they're trying to get away from watching television because they're seeing all these spots saying he's tied to the mafia. And he goes to a movie theater
with his wife to kind of get away and relax.
And what happens?
Well, I was tough on Alan. He'd represented a number of the insurance companies went under, and I needed to win this election. You know, I was under the gun myself, and I needed to win this election. I was very aggressive against him, and so I was running TV spots saying that he was representing all these insurance crooks, and his poor wife and he wanted to get away for the evening, went to the movie theater. Well, my father-in-law happened to own the movie theater, and of course, they sit down with their pop. Alan tells me this story. He's a great guy. I like him. Sit down with his popcorn and his Coke and his wife, and they take a deep breath and relax, and on the screen comes Alan Boudreaux. He's a crook. They both got up and left the movie theater. His poor wife was crying. I really felt bad about that. But politics, you know, there's rough edges to it. You've got to have a tough skin. You can't take it personally. And I understand that. And that's just part of the airing in which we end. Negative campaigning. Everybody despises negative campaigning, but it works. Unfortunately, it works. Everybody like to talk about their record, but it just doesn't happen in politics. And so when someone takes a pot shot at you, you got to kind of stand your ground. But out of all of that, usually you hope that the cream rises to the top. You hope that happens. Sometimes it does, we've seen in Louisiana. Other times we find that we've maybe been conned a bit, and so that's why we have elections.
But I can only imagine if you were in a runoff with somebody like David Vitter, it would be brutal because you basically, look, if you get in the ring with me, you better bring your A game.
Yeah, Vitter's a tough campaigner. On the other hand, he's a very bright guy. You know, David Vitter's a Rhodes Scholar, and he's always run against the establishment in the legislature. He was the man out. He was running against other politicians. He was against giving legislators Tulane scholarships. And so he had a feisty spirit about it that, quite frankly, it was very appealing to a number of independents. Now, has he gotten hardened in a conservative, more Tea Party-related mode to where he's not going to look at the bigger view and being in his race for governor of Louisiana? That's going to be interesting to see.
Johnny downtown. Johnny, good morning. You're on with Jim Brown.
Morning. I want to commend Mr. Brown on his political astuteness and also comment that he is very much into music. I remember he showed up to see Marsha Ball and Mose Allison. In addition to being a track star. One other thing, how do you critique your brother-in-law, Mr. Carter?
I hate to bring in the family. My brother-in-law, Steve Carter, representative, is the chairman of the House Education Committee. Lost a number of pieces of legislation, some Governor Jindal vetoed, but is very active in terms of education reform in the state. His heart's in the right place. He's fought the good fight, but he's still got a long way to go. You know, we've got a long way of building a consensus as to what works educational-wise. So I'm for him. I don't disown him, and he'll be back there fighting next year. As far as the music, by the way, I go to the Red Dragon listening room about once a week. I was there to hear Ramblin' Jack Elliott sing last week, and I just bought myself a new tenor guitar, and I got a mandolin I'm getting tuned up to. So anytime you want to have a little hoedown, give me a call, because I love our way of music down here.
That's Johnny Palazzotto, the man who brought the Blues Fest to Baton Rouge. Lynn in Melrose. Lynn, good morning. You're on with Jim Brown.
Good morning, Jim and Jim. I wanted to get back to the congressional race between Edward Edwards and a number of other candidates, and I'm glad to hear you mention, Jim, that the governor supports the lawsuit against the 97 oil and gas companies. I would suggest that could be the coastal issue could be big in that congressional race, and I've volunteered to give Edward Edwards advice on the coast, which I've already sent him some information. So this is going to be a very interesting race. Dan Clater and Garrett Graves, I think, are the main competitors with him. And I sure hope that Edwin makes it to the runoff at least.
Well, that's going to be, I think it's going to be the defining issue, quite frankly. I think in the runoff, and that's going to be the issue. And if Edwin Edwards wins, that's going to be the issue to get him elected, quite frankly.
We'll be back in 90 seconds for a few more minutes with Jim Brown on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Jim Brown, and then we'll hear from the fabulous photographer Matt Heron. Jim Brown, a man who has been in Louisiana politics for well over four decades and has seen many governors come and go. And next year, we've got an election. How do you see the race for governor in 2015?
Still got a long way to work out. I think that Vitter looks awfully strong in terms of his ability to raise the money and is going to be right now probably the leading candidate. On the other hand, Democrats are going to have a lot to say about this. If they don't get a candidate in the runoff, and I guess the current money says it'll probably be two Republicans, let's assume that Jay Darden gets in or if John Kennedy runs, then the Democrats could decide who the governor is going to be. A united Democratic effort could put their support behind one candidate or the other, and that could make the difference, number one. That's the number one factor. The number two factor is I think there is certainly room for an independent or someone who's not been in politics before who can emerge and run a very aggressive race if he or she can come up with the financing. You hear the name Jim Bernhardt, who's been mentioned before, used to be head of Shaw, and someone along that line. I think there is plenty of room for growth if people have just had their fill of the political establishment and want someone fresh and new. So a long way to go, but it's shaping up as a very fascinating race.
Jeff in Goodwood, please make your remarks concise. You're on the air with Jim Brown. Hi, Jeff.
Jim and Jim, good morning. My question is does Bobby Jindal really believe he can win a national election with that far-right agenda? I mean, the country is not that far-right. What's his strategy?
Well, I think that all these folks that take off in the presidential elections think that maybe lightning may struck. I mean, nobody thought Bill Clinton would ever get the nomination to begin with, and so everyone has hopes they can make it. But if you're advising Jindal, you say, look, you've kind of reached a dead end in Louisiana. There's no future for you here, and so therefore, at your young age, your only chance is to have some impact on the national level. If he runs and runs a respectable race and a Republican would be elected president, then there may be a role for Jindal in some national administration. That's what I think his advisors are telling him. He might be a secretary or an undersecretary in a Republican administration. And if not, you know, he's very young, not that old. What is Jindal, 42?
43
years old. So, I mean, 8 years from now, you know, he's going to be a little over 50. 16 years from now, he's going to be 58, much younger than Hillary Clinton, the leading Democrat, is right now. So I think he's just positioning himself to build base, build IOUs, and hopefully something happens later on down the line. I don't think we'll be seeing much of Bobby Jindal in the future in Louisiana. I think he'll be off on the national scene one way or the other.
Final inquiry for Jim Brown from a listener asking if Vitter is elected governor, who does he appoint as his successor to the Senate?
Well, that's interesting. You know, it would be illegal for someone to make a deal with him. Say another statewide official will say, look, I'm going to actively throw my support to you, but I'd like to be appointed U.S. Senator. That would be a criminal violation to do something like that. So Vitter cannot make any deal to get some support. But, gosh, who knows? Would he appoint a caretaker, someone within the Republican base to enhance his own situation? Would he, if John Kennedy runs for re-election, would he pick someone like John Kennedy? Who knows what's going on in David Vitter's mind? That'll be an interesting scenario.
That should be an issue, though, because his campaign apparatus is now surrounding Congressman Cassidy. Vitter's former press secretary is Cassidy's guy, and Joel DeGrotto, and Vitter's people are around Cassidy. So Bill Cassidy, if he wins, will be beholden to David Vitter. And the next senator certainly will, because if Vitter becomes governor, Vitter is the person who will make the call as to who succeeds him. So he will have the governorship and two U.S. Senate seats possibly in his grasp.
It's not going to the fascinating rough and tumble politics in Louisiana are not going to slow down. It's going to be fascinating to be a watcher, probably more so than any time in the last 20 years, coming up in the next year or so, Jim.
And David Vitter, who has survived a big scandal, has emerged as perhaps the foremost politician in Louisiana until further notice. And then there's Steve Scalise, who in 6 years has risen to the number three spot among the majority in Congress. and in the U.S. House, and he was the successor to Bobby Jindal. That shows you how short a time he's been there, and yet he's pulled this off and arguably has risen to higher levels nationally than has the governor.
Hope that bodes well for Louisiana. Often you get these national posts, and it's great for the individual, but in terms of how it enhances Louisiana, that's a personal picadillo we'll talk about in the future. All these fellas and ladies go up and be big shot committee chairman, and then we never see them again. They never come back to Louisiana. Their added value that they gain with their connections mm-hmm. and their knowledge doesn't come back to enhance Louisiana. So I hope Scalise will be the big shot in the national level and be the party whip, but don't forget the folks back home and hopefully use that strength to bring some added value to us back here in Louisiana.
Well, thank you, Jim Brown. It is always a pleasure, and let's do it again soon.
Look forward to it, Jim.
We're joined now by the fabulous photographer, Matt Herron. His new book is Mississippi Eyes, the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and the Freedom Summer. This year, 1964, was when the world was changing right before our eyes and Matt's camera. Matt has been in Jackson and in New Orleans in recent days, chronicling the events and the powerful witness of five young photographers in the Southern Documentary Project. Good morning, Matt Herron.
Good morning, Jim. I'm glad to be here.
Well, good to talk with you. And you were there 50 years ago. It was quite a time, an unfortunate time, but I guess if you're a journalist, and photographers are journalists, there's no better place to be than where the action is.
Well, that's certainly true, but also that's where my heart was. I came down from Philadelphia to, actually I thought of myself as wearing three hats. I was starting my budding career as a photojournalist, but I also was working with SNCC and other civil rights organizations, helping them set up their photo systems. And later in 1964, I was working with Dorothea Lange, the famous documentary photographer, to field my own team of documentary photographers, which, of course, was the subject of the book.
Well, you've been in practically every major magazine in the world, your work has, and you covered the civil rights struggle in all its tragedy. But in 1964, you'd only been doing this for a few years.
Yeah, actually, my wife and I arrived in Jackson in the summer of 63, right after Medgar Evers was assassinated. We were the only family with children, 3 and 5 years old, to move south and join the civil rights movement, at least as helpers to the movement. So I guess you learn fast and grow up in a hurry. Mm-hmm. At any rate, by the following summer, when the decision was made to bring 1,000 college students into the state to see what could be done in one summer to advance civil rights, I was trying to figure out what my role was. And I had worked to set up a documentary project earlier in New York, and I thought, well, this is the time. So I contacted Dorothea, and she helped me, and I recruited some photographers, and we started work. And we had a very intensive summer.
297-5633 for photographer Matt Herron, who's been taking photographs for over 50 years and has a collection of work that typifies what happened in our area a half century ago and beyond. What are some of the most vivid photographs you took regarding civil rights?
Probably the most vivid photograph was not taken during that summer. In the summer of the following year, 1965, I happened upon a little demonstration on the side steps of the governor's mansion in Jackson. And Mrs. Eileen Quinn of Macomb, Mississippi, was sitting on the steps with her three children, holding small American flags and a sign protesting an election of state senators in which no blacks were allowed to vote. As I arrived, the police had come in and were about to arrest everybody because it was illegal in Jackson to carry a sign or state your views in public without a permit. So the police were leading away little 5-year-old Anthony Quinn. And Anthony was holding a small American flag. And in those days, flags had really strong significance. An American flag, if you held an American flag, it said, I would like the laws of the United States to be enforced in Mississippi and in the South. And of course, if you had the opposite view, you probably had a Confederate flag in the back of your pickup truck. So the policeman reached for the flag, and Mrs. Quinn said, Anthony, don't let that man take your flag. And Anthony held on to it. He later told me I was more afraid of my mama than I was of the policeman. Anyway, the policeman reacted spontaneously and I think reflexively, and he lifted Anthony off his feet with his grasping the flag, trying to wrench it out of his hands. And I was right in there with a 24-millimeter lens almost on top of him, just shooting instinctively. And in the background, the gods who smile on photographers gave me a policeman who was holding a sign that said, no more police brutality. At any rate, the picture won the World Press Photo Contest for 1965 and became sort of, I guess, one of my icons. And the interesting thing is that when we get to Jackson tomorrow, Anthony Quinn will be back there. I reached him for the first time in my life. He's a school principal in Florida now. And we had to talk about it, and we're going to conduct a tour of my show, and we're going to talk about that picture.
Now, he was 5 in 1965?
Yeah.
So he'd be 54 now.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's had an interesting, varied, and somewhat difficult life, but he's come out with a PhD, and he's done very well for himself.
That is wonderful. You were taking photos for Life and for Look in the Saturday Evening Post at this time, and talk about being devoted to the craft and the work you were doing. You actually moved to Mississippi, didn't you?
Yeah, we moved to Jackson. My wife came south first. She came to Medgar River's funeral, and she also had the mission to see whether it would be safe to move into Mississippi with our children without endangering them. And she was told that if we lived in Jackson in a white neighborhood, we'd be okay. So that's what we did. And we were there until the following summer, when our landlord suddenly announced that he was going to remodel the house and we'd better move out. Janine took the kids to Atlanta and worked with Julian Bond in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee office, organizing the darkroom and seeing that pictures got printed and film developed and pictures sent out around the world. And I was, of course, running my project team, so I was living pretty much out of the trunk of my car. And I also moved to a small black community in the Delta, Milestone, and made it my operations base there.
How was that experience?
Pretty intense, very interesting, totally engrossing. I photographed the Freedom School in Milestone, and I made forays into the countryside. I did an essay that I really love on a small church in Valley View, Mississippi, which was a sharecropper's church. It was so poor that they could only afford a preacher once a month, but that Sunday service was the most important day of the week for those folks. That was the day when they gave and received respect from each other, and they wore their best clothes. The preacher later told me that some of them walked the dusty roads to church in their bare feet, carrying their shoes so they would be spotless when they put them on for church. And I photographed that service, and afterward, I was behind the church building, and there was a group of young boys gathered, and I said, "Let me take your picture." And they all stood up in a glade of trees, and I photographed them, and it's the picture on the back of the book and one of my favorite photographs. And one of the boys became the cover of the book.
The book is Mississippi Eyes, and we're short on time, but we had a listener, and I think this is worth mentioning, asking about your connection to Jim Garrison. You got involved with him, didn't you?
I did. I got on a plane as soon as I heard of the assassination, went to Dallas, and was there when, you know, with the whole press pack as that story unfolded. And I found myself looking at the Dallas scene differently than most of the other journalists. And I later asked myself, why is this? And the word came to me, I'm looking at Dallas through Mississippi eyes. And what I mean by that is that we became trained in Mississippi to be distrustful of what officials told us and to try and figure it out for ourselves. So later, I was living in New Orleans at that time, and I made connections with Jim.
Well, unfortunately, we've got to leave on that note, Matt, but we'll pick it up, so I hope sometime soon, and find out about you and Jim Garrison. Until tomorrow, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.